Today. 2 hours of news, current affairs, and opinion. With in-depth panel discussions on domestic and global issues. Today brings you the story behind the headlines. Locally produced, but with a distinctly international flavor. Today.
You're back with Today on News Plus. I'm Ben Leung, and joining us for the second hour of Today for Global Talk is Jindo. Jindo, new week.
Yeah, new week.
We thought it'd be airstrikes by now, but no airstrikes.
Well, that's a lot of people were expecting. Actually, last Thursday, but
right.
Obviously,
exactly.
Then French president mentioned about before September 4th.
September.
Now, it seems from now, so it's still a few days away. Waiting for the approval from the Congress in the United States.
Because the Congress isn't due back until almost 10 years.
So basically,
it will not happen before the G20, or it'll be after, right?
Probably.
We presume.
Yeah, not this week. It's interesting to think about the role to be played or be played right now being played by the Arab League. I think, of course, U.S. President Obama is seeking the authorization, legitimacy, let's say, if not from UN, but at least from the Congress. I mean, but the Arab League is a support of a military attack will give it some legitimacy, right?
Legitimacy to whom, though? I mean, Arab League is just Sunni, 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 Sunni.
Yeah, but at least from the name, it's Arab League. Yeah.
That's, I mean, if you read into it, then you know, that's just, they're almost, might as well be
that's
called America,
true.
Right?
That's true, yeah.
Thanks for that. First, the main world news read by Mark Evigley. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Ben. Thank you very much. Our top global stories of the day are the UN inspectors continue their lab tests for the alleged chemical weapon attacks in Syria, militants attack a Costco ship at the Suez Canal, Angela Merkel battles her main rival in a TV debate ahead of the election, Venezuela's finance minister comments on the late Chavez's economic policies, and the U.S. intelligence agency's black budget disclosed.
We'll talk about those in a moment, but first our global survey of headlines. First up here in Asia, Japanese authorities are warning radiation levels around the country's Fukushima nuclear plant are 18 times higher than previously thought. In China, a chemical leak of liquid ammonia from a cold storage unit in Shanghai has killed 15 people. And North Korea has revoked an invitation for a U.S. envoy to travel to Pyongyang to seek the release of an American citizen.
And in Oceania, the Australian Labor Party has officially launched its 2013 election campaign in Brisbane, Queensland. Also in the country, the latest survey shows a clear majority of Australians are in favor of recognizing Indigenous Australians in the Constitution.
Moving on to Africa, Ghana's Supreme Court has dismissed an appeal by the opposition to annul President John Mahama's narrow victory in last year's disputed election. Senegalese President Macky Sall has sacked the technocrat Prime Minister Abdou Mbaye and replaced him with Justice Minister Aminata Touré. In South Africa, former President Nelson Mandela has left hospital and has gone to his Johannesburg home, where he is continuing to receive intensive care.
In the Middle East, Lebanon has charged two religious clerics over bombings which killed at least 42 people at two mosques in the northern city of Tripoli last week. In Iraq, violence has erupted at a local camp for dissident Iranians, allegedly killing dozens of residents there.
Looking to Latin America, in Mexico, riot police in the capital's Mexico City are clashing near Congress with students opposed to the government's education reforms. Unusually cold weather and snow in parts of South America have affected thousands of people in several countries. Colombia is deploying troops in the capital, Bogota, following violent protests in support of a strike by small-scale farmers.
In Europe, in Germany, a 92-year-old former SS officer will go on trial for the murder of a Dutch resistance fighter during the Second World War. At the Vatican, Pope Francis has named Archbishop Pietro Parolin as his new Secretary of State. In Turkey, a trial will open of alleged coup plotters accused of ousting a pro-Islamist government in 1997.
And finally, in North America, the U.S. government says it will not sue to stop the states of Colorado and Washington from legalizing recreational use of marijuana. And the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has become the first judge on the country's highest court to perform a same-sex marriage.
And that's Monday's Global Headline Survey. Now with more on the top stories of the day with Mark.
Thank you, Ben. The United Nations weapon inspectors are stepping up their lab tests on samples collected from Damascus for the suspected use of chemical weapons. It comes after the United States claims to have firm evidence. Here are some more details. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has asked the head of the UN Chemical Weapons Inspection Team to speed up the analysis of tests from samples collected in Syria. Martin Nasirki is the top UN spokesman.
In light of the horrendous magnitude of the 21st of August incident in the Ghouta area of Damascus, the Secretary General asked Dr. Selstrom to expedite the mission's analysis of the samples and information it had obtained without jeopardizing the scientific timelines required for accurate analysis, and to report the results to him as soon as possible. And they discussed ways to further accelerate the process.
The UN spokesman added that samples will now be sent to laboratories around Europe for examinations, but he declined to say when the results might be in. Over in the U.S., one piece of key evidence of chemical weapons deployment in the August 21st attack appears to have been found. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said samples collected by first responders of the attack have tested positive for the nerve agent sarin.
I can tell you today, Sunday, that we now have evidence from hair and blood samples from first responders in East Damascus, the people who came to help. We have signatures of sarin in their hair and blood samples. So the case is growing stronger by the day. And I believe that as we go forward here in the next days, the Congress will recognize that we cannot allow Assad to be able to gas people with impunity.
Kerry's statement came one day after President Barack Obama announced that he had decided to defer any immediate action in Syria in order to seek authorization from Congress. This, in effect, has pushed off any military action until September 9th, when the U.S. Congress reconvenes. Meanwhile, the Arab League has toughened its tone and called for punitive action against the Syrian government after an emergency meeting in Cairo. Saud al-Faisal is a Saudi foreign minister.
Along with the Syrian people and their representatives recognized by the Arab League, we demand the international community to take all the necessary measures to help them and stop the hooliganism of the Syrian government.
The 22-nation bloc said they held the Syrian government responsible for the deadly attack, but didn't say if they will take part in any military action against Syria. Earlier, the UK has ruled out taking part in any attack after Prime Minister David Cameron failed to win the support of Parliament last week. That leaves France as the only other major power that could partner with the US in a strike against Syria.
And interestingly, of course, if Britain is out of it and France goes it alone, and that's two of the kind of imperial powers of Syria, one of them out of the equation already. Mm-hmm. We talked about in the first hour, you know, how Arabs react to this. And obviously, it's a moral intervention, you can say humanitarian grounds, but obviously there are political implications and, you know, Western imperialist agenda. It's how most Arabs are going to see it, whether you're Sunni or Shia.
Well, interestingly, of course, there's different opinions on the street and also from the government side. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you do have the support from many Arab countries, say Saudi Arabia, Qatar,
Sunni. Sunni.
Jordan, yeah, Sunni. Mostly Sunni government over there. So different opinions on the street, people will see it differently, in a different way, let's say.
But some of the rebels are already saying, you know, this is a catastrophe for us. So, you know, we were waiting for you to strike by Sunday. We're not going to have anything for another 9 days or whatever. And
no.
That means Assad can move his people, move more human shields into military depots and his arms to different places.
But for me, the still, I think there's a tricky issue. It remains unresolved. That is, like, first of all, you need hard evidence. Secondly, you need evidence to show the Syrian government was responsible for the attack. And right now, of course, there's different explanations. Some say probably it's the rebel forces who used the chemical weapon in the first place. So we don't know yet. And then we're waiting for the outcome of this lab tests in the UN, of course. It will usually take like 2 weeks' time, 14 days. Yeah. But now they are speeding up. Maybe another week. We don't know yet. But, you know, results would be like, of course, if there's a clear result that is the Syrian government, then, you know, green light from the UN, basically. And no country will oppose it. It's harder to oppose, right? Any military action. What if there's a result indicating, of course, there's the use of chemical weapons, but they are not clear who used the chemical weapons? Then in a very gray area. And another case, another situation that is like they point to the use of chemical weapons, but also pointing to the to the rebel forces. What do you want to do? That's a very awkward moment.
And that's why both Obama and Cameron have said we can't be 100% sure. And that's why many people are actually, protesting already, saying, no intervention in Syria on the streets of Washington, in London, and Downing Street, and all the rest of it. But, at the same time, I made a point last week that 100,000 people had already died. 1.7 million refugees, I think, in Lebanon and Syria, now into Iraq. Do we just let people keep dying, or is this the best way forward? Because afterwards, it could be a Pandora's box of sectarian violence and regional all-out conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis and Russia and America being drawn in. Because you can't just launch surgical strikes. Martin Dempsey, who's one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said you can't just go in, bomb, go out, because you need to go in and commit troops to perhaps secure chemical weapons, have a no-fly zone. And that's, you can't just go in and out and just like that.
That is the uncertain part, it's always easy to start a military strike or start a war. The hard part is to finish it.
Exactly.
Egyptian officials say they have foiled an attack on a container ship intended to disrupt shipping in the busy Suez Canal. A terrorist element targeted the Panama-flagged vessel, but it was undamaged. The unconfirmed reports say there were two explosions as the ship Costco Asia passed through the waterway. Meanwhile, ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi will soon stand trial for inciting murder.
Yeah, and two other bits of news as well from Egypt over the weekend is that Mohamed Badi, who's the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, he had a heart attack on Saturday, but he's fine. It was non-fatal. Mohamed Al-Bategi, who's one of the senior leaders, has been arrested. He was arrested, I think, on Thursday or Friday. So that's all the upper echelons of the Muslim Brotherhood all in jail. And the curfew, which has been in place since end of July, has been shortened daily to, it will start at 11 p.m. and finishing early in the morning, but not on Fridays because of fear of, protests and demonstrations.
Right.
But all of these, take away from the main news here is that there was an attack by militants possibly on the Suez Canal at a Costco ship was foiled. No other details as to who could have done it or who could have been behind it, but that's the Suez Canal, which is in the Sinai Peninsula, which has been the most restless most restless area of Egypt way before Mohamed Morsi was ousted.
Well, exactly. Of course, as you pointed out, we don't know, have the details available yet. Of course, the government would point the finger at the, a brotherhood-related, the militants attack. Now, not only against the government in Egypt, but also, say, international container, shipping container over there. So that's, totally different story right now we have. That is, of course, this is, Suez Canal is very important. For businesses, of course, running through the Port Said and the
Port
Suez,
Said,
Red Sea and the Mediterranean for Asian countries, Americans and the European countries' business. This waterway is critical. Yeah. Remember history, there were wars over the control.
1956.
Suez Canal. So that's about business, internationally concerned. Yeah. So if it's out of control, it went out of control, that would be not only an Egyptian matter, it's an international issue now.
Yeah, former Egyptian president nationalized the Suez Canal in 56, which of course led to a war with France and Britain trying to take it back, but Britain was defeated, and the Suez Canal has remained with Egyptian hand ever since. And of course, Costco is a Chinese shipping company. China has Costco, along with Maersk and I think China Shipping Company, have built terminals at either end of the Suez Canal. It cost them, I think, $11 billion, opened in the last two or three years. So China has a very important and strategic interest, and economic interest, of course, in its expansion into Africa and also into Europe with this Suez Canal. So for them, the security of the Suez Canal is hugely important. At the same time, Mohamed Morsi is going to go on trial in December for premeditated murders of anti-Morsi protesters outside his presidential palace in December 2012. So this is backdating to I think a year ago.
Right, this is a winner's trial, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if he had tried Hosni Mubarak who has since been released and then retried for another crime, premeditated murders. And now, with a new government and regime in place, Mohamed Morsi, who's been under house arrest since the 3rd of July, he's now about to go on trial in December this year. So that could be inflaming the situation further.
Well, definitely. The chaos will continue with the trial of Morsi and his colleagues over there. And, you know, people would naturally ask, what about the killing of this hundreds of protesters, you know, a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. right? You know, mostly supporters. So, I don't know. I think it's simply you need to stabilize the country, not only for the country's own sake, but also for Suez Canal, because Egypt, a lot of revenue is from the use of the Suez Canal by foreign.
I could be wrong here. I think it's 11 something million dollars a day, maybe a bit more.
Yeah, it's an important resource for the country's revenue.
And if you ever go to the Suez Canal, I mean, it's the security going to it is very, very, very tight. Mm-hmm. There are lots of armed soldiers standing guard alongside it. The tunnel that goes under it is, you know, it dips under the canal quite early. So there's a huge amount of ground between the tunnels for vehicles and, you know, and coaches. But once you get to actually Port Said, it's not that difficult to. You can take pictures of the canal quite readily. But once you get to Port Said, if you have a boat, to bomb any of these boats is not that difficult, I can tell you.
So that's a dangerous part.
Very dangerous part.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel and center-left rival Pierre Steinbrück are taking part in a televised debate ahead of this month's election. Early in the debate, Merkel said Germany had more employed people than ever and job prospects were good.
Wir können einfach den Menschen in diesem Lande sagen, dass wir das schaffen können, dass es weiter.
We can simply tell the people in this country that we can achieve further progress. The work is of course not over yet. Of course there are many worries, many woes, but we have shown that we can do it. And that in a difficult time, in a time during which we had the worst European crisis. Now, Germany is a strong, Germany is a growth motor, Germany is an anchor for stability, and I want to continue on this path. And I think that what we have shown really convinces people.
Steinbrück accused Merkel of violating her oath of office concerning the NSA spying issue by not preventing the surveillance. They also touched upon the topic of Syria.
Yeah, and if I was going to say earlier, if these airstrikes go in the next 11, 12 days, it could actually happen during the election in Germany, because it's scheduled for, I think, 20th of September or thereabouts, third week anyway. First indication is that it was a score draw. It's the only debate. There was no knockout punch from either side. Angela Merkel stood her ground, looks awkward as she usually does in these things. Steinbrück, you know, talks, but no major gaffes, which he's prone to. But there are, you know, major differences between the two sides. I mean, Merkel's, they reckon, is going to win big, but not enough to secure a majority, so she needs to find a coalition partner, and her coalition partners aren't doing that well at the moment. And Steinbrück was her previous coalition partner and has said we will not be in any coalition this time because they have various differences in taxes. Steinbrück wants to, for the Social Democrats, wants to tax the rich a bit more. Merkel is, you know, Christian Democrats, right wing, no more taxes for the rich. Merkel doesn't have a minimum wage because she wants individuals to set the wages, whereas Steinbrück says no, we need minimum wage to make economic disparity much less of a thing of the past. So there are differences, but we don't think that Steinbrück is going to crawl back any of the Merkel lead.
Yeah, at least according to the poll, right after the debate, you see there's still a tie between the two of them. So Merkel and her party, of course, still enjoys like 15% of lead over the in opinion court there. The differences, of course, is about like a Germany's EU policy and austerity for some of the European countries, especially southern European countries. That's one of the debating topic. Mm. You know, whether it is wise, whether it is proper or not. Of course, Steinbrück, that is too much a lethal dose of treatment for some of the European countries. But then, you know, Merkel can say, you were my finance minister from 2005 to 2009.
You signed off every agreement.
Right, you signed up with all the treatment over there. So now...
You're flip-flopping.
Yeah, right, exactly. And also, I think, when it comes to another topic, that's German economy. The economy is health. I agree with Merkel, sort of. It's an anchor of stability in Asia, you know, Europe, so motor of growth, so-called. I think partly because Germany's export, especially to China, has been growing despite all the financial crisis over the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, remember those, those crabs, and they're coming this way as well.
Right. So I think on the whole, the economy, you know, is helpful to her re-election, let's say. Yeah. There seems little doubt about that. It's about the uncertainty is about what kind of coalition she's going to have.
Because employment is up, 0.7% growth in the last quarter.
Right.
All these have come in time just for the election, you know, for her. She cannot, you know, she portrays herself as a safe pair of hands. And Germans like that.
Well, especially in difficult financial time in the European continent. Yeah.
Venezuela's finance minister has acknowledged the economic policies of late President Hugo Chavez and his successor have yet to prove successful. Nelson Marentes says the government had improved the living standards of many Venezuelans, but not solved the structural problems of the economy. He claims laws must be reformed to stimulate growth.
Yeah, he says the monetary policy of Chavez, nationalization plans, and mismanagement of public funds mean that you know, the country's economy has been in pretty dire straits, and laws must be reformed. And Venezuela has the highest inflation in the whole of Latin America.
43%.
Right.
This is just unbearable for a lot of people. Of course, there's still a severe shortage of consumer goods, daily consumer goods, so people are still complaining.
Yeah.
Their manufacturing actually is catching up. If you say the economic expansion in the second quarter is like 2.6%, so of course it's much better than the first 3 months. I think it's like over 1.5% or something. So it's still much better than the first 3 months, but far poorer than last year. Last year's 5.6% in the second quarter. But then, of course, the country's economy, it's about the model, I would say, the model of economic growth. Over the past, say, more than a decade, 14 years, especially under Chavez, the rule of Chavez, you can see there's the nationalization, there's a lot of investment for, say, home building projects from the oil money. But then the thing is about like how sustainable that kind of program. And with the nationalization drive of the country's business, you do see there's a weakened private sector. You know, private business owners, they don't have the desire or incentive to invest more or to expand their business, to employ more people, or to you do see not seeing like private sector growing, but the whole public sector, there are problems for like a big investment, but you know, mishandling some of the investment, and also the issue of corruption there.
Mm.
The quote-unquote black budget for several U.S. intelligence agencies has been revealed in files disclosed by leaker Edward Snowden to the Washington Post. The file shows the CIA's budget is the most expensive, $14.7 billion U.S. dollars out of $52.6 billion in total, for 16 intelligence agencies. The newspaper published charts detailing the budget, but did not post all the documents after U.S. officials expressed concerns about risks to the sources.
Yeah, so 52.6 is the total budget, that's billion dollars. CIA's is 14.7. The NSA, which has very much been in the news for the last 2 months or 3 months, 10.8 billion. The most eye-catching one for me is $67 million have been spent on false IDs for our spies and agents abroad. $67 million.
Well, identification, the operation is costly, right?
Overseas spies. The other thing which is fascinating is that China, Russia, Iran, Cuba are the priority for the counterintelligence targets, as well as Israel.
Israel. Interesting,
Israel.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a bit hard to understand in the first place.
Yeah. Israel's also spied on the US. I mean, that's...
Previously, at least. So
found... to actually bracket Israel alongside China, Russia, Iran, Cuba is... you know, that's quite something.
Yeah,
quite the top five.
That's probably the biggest revolution for the Israelis to see, wow, we were also being spied by our ally, most important ally of Israel, of course. And interesting about the CIA, I think it's, you know, people call it a black budget. Basically, all those budget are secret. basically, somehow
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, for obvious reasons. And also withheld from American people. That's a portion of the budget. I'm not sure whether that's a total budget for the 16 intelligence agencies here. Especially with the CIA, of course. People can complain about, definitely the legitimate to complain about the Obama administration. Obama has, once said that, his administration is the most transparent in U.S. history. So, yes, a lot of secret operations.
Having said that, though, I mean, there are certain things that should be off limits, are there not?
But what about the budget? You can definitely say so in public. Yeah, we have a budget for this year for the 60 intelligence agencies. Is that hurting national security or agency? No. So that's why they call it a black budget. And of course, most surprising part probably is for CIA, not only for the largest portion of those total secret budget, but also CIA, remember what happened, say, after September 11 attack, because of their failure in the intelligence gathering, and also because of another failure that led to the Iraq War in 2003, 2 years after the September 11 attack, right? Yeah. Many people believe CIA was somehow, losing at that time the prestige or the status, right, privileged status in U.S. among U.S. intelligence agencies. Then the new National Security Agency, National Security Department. So people say somehow the role of CIA was reduced or was affected adversely. But now you see a huge growth, actually, more than 50% of growth since that time, the budget here.
Well, let's see if they've got the intelligence for Syria right this time. thanks, Mark. Up next, new PMI figures for August is out, and it's good news. And new regulations kicking for us foreigners hoping to work and reside in China. All that to come in the next 29 minutes.
You're listening to Today. I'm Xu Qinduo with Ben Liang in the Global Talk. Bringing us the news in China is Zhu Jingnan.
Thank you, Qinduo. With Jiang Jieming, head of the State-Owned Assets Supervision and Administration Commission of the State Council, is under investigation now for suspected serious disciplinary violations. China's Ministry of Supervision made the announcement on its official website Sunday, but did not specify the alleged breaches. Jiang Jieming was the former board chairman of the China National Petroleum Corporation. He was appointed to his current position in March.
So only 5 months in, and then he's a goner. So China National Petroleum Corporation has been in the news a lot in the last 4 or 5 days. Environmental breaches, and of course the dismissal, sacking, stroke investigation of 5 officials. Now we've got one of them, Mr. Jiang.
Oh, well, that's the latest one. It came as a surprise to a lot of people because, as you mentioned, he was promoted to this head of the State-Owned Assets Supervision and Administration Commission earlier, say, less than 6 months ago, earlier this year, in March, actually. So, a few people would expect such a promotion as an investigation into his, past performance, either in CNPC, the National Petroleum Company, or in this regulating body itself there. So, of course, the announcement came just right after the investigation against the four top executives of CNPC, the China Petroleum Company here. Mostly, it's about, people believe it's about the corruption, in their handling of the business. CNPC has seen rapid expansion, especially overseas expansion, and also one of its sub-company, the China PetroChina, listed in Hong Kong, of course, was viewed as one of the top big oil companies around the world and the most valuable one too. So, of course, during the whole expansion process, people believe there were some mishandling or improper business deals. Maybe, of course, that's all the guesswork. Let's say. But if you look at the charges from the disciplinaries, commission, they say serious discipline violations. We don't know the charges, the accusations. There's no details about the accusations yet. But from this, definitive phrase, serious discipline violations, you can see the nature probably is serious.
But that's a fairly bog standard phrase now, is it, against most officials who are implicated in corruption scandals? A serious violation of discipline. You can read between the lines as to like what it's going to be about.
Well, yeah, that's right. There's a different speculations, I guess, now about what really happened to him, or you know what he did, wrong over the past decades, probably during his tenure, especially in the oil field.
So that's interesting. He only got promoted to the job in March. So then they would have okayed his promotion because they weren't looking into his past then. So that's some kind of questions for whoever that appointed him at the time, perhaps.
Yeah, good point. I think, some people are discussing about, if there was anything wrong, proven to be wrong, then we can ask the question, who did the promotion for Mr. Jiang? Because it's only like 5 months ago, right?
5 months, right? I mean, we're not talking about a hasty promotion. We're talking about something which would have, I guess, they would have considered.
Very recent.
Background checks.
Yeah, right. What about the background checks? So... anyway, I think it represents this, determination. It's also the part of the a comprehensive war against the corruption launched by basically President Xi Jinping himself. We can see this, the fight, was touted about not only against the flies, say low-ranking officials or bureaucrats, but also tigers, say high-ranking officials, and the Mr. Jiang obviously falls into the second category, the tigers, right? Ministerial level officials, the first
I saw
one,
some tigers. Oh, was it one tiger at the Beijing Zoo yesterday? Looked quite pretty, I have to say. now, of course, the general manager of the state-owned company, China Mobile, is also under investigation for disciplinary. Violation as well. Guangdong, I think.
Yeah, this is if you see the investigation against these executives of either CNPC or China Mobile, all of them have one thing in common. That's state-owned big companies.
Because I think that's the body that oversees these state-owned companies. I mean, there are 116 of them that oversees the administrative body.
That's right. Assets
Supervision and Administration Commission.
Yeah, that's previously under Mr. Jiang, we can say. So it shows they are targeting those the big monopoly state-owned companies right now. Previously, they were somehow off-limit, basically.
Yeah. Internal purges.
So this gave a lot of people some encouragement to see, the central government is serious in the investigation, in the crackdown of corruption or bribery or misbehavior by the top executives there.
New data suggests China's manufacturing sector saw strong recovery in August. The Purchasing Managers Index for the manufacturing sector rose to 51 in August from 50.3 in July. The figure marks the second monthly expansion in a row. It is also the highest reading in 16 months since last April.
HSBC will also have its own data being published today. It's its own PMI, which looks into smaller and medium-sized firms. So we'll know tomorrow. We'll talk about it tomorrow. But the expectation is that it's going to be fairly probably in the positive territory as well. And this one, the PMI overall, 51. They'd expected 50.6. 51 is higher than 50.6, so it's exceeded expectation, and 0.7 higher than July, which was only 50.3.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, overall, if you see, take a look at the analysis and comments from economists and the economic observers overall, at the latest figures, they do see it a very positive, very rosy picture, indicating a stability for the economic growth or economic recovery, let's say, for the latter half of this year, let's say. And also, of course, it is after, some of the financial policies in the first half of this year. So they call it lagging effects.
Credit
now
growth.
It's we are seeing the effects on economic growth, credit. And also, of course, we have talked about this, a policy to basically to protect the small and businesses, but in terms of tax policies, some
giving
of them
tax breaks,
breaks for them, and so of course the welcome of this investment from the private sector to the railway and other sectors, I think, also plays a role. Encouraging the people's expectation for next half of the year.
Because the government says this analysts say this is you know, the government's you know, doing by having clearer, more coherent economic policies that people can then latch onto and analyze and have, you know, maybe feed off a little bit, so that they can have more confidence in how the economy is going to, which way it's going to go. But at the same time, it also justifies the government's decision to not pump in more money. So they said no quantitative easing for this year. And again, you know, this is the fastest pace, you know, of growth in the last year, this particular PMI. So this justifies their decision to not pump any more money into it.
Well, that's a good point. Yes, definitely. So, you know, there's a, give the government more reason not to pump, say, you know, credit or liquidity into the market. People still remember, of course, after the 2008 financial crisis, the Chinese government promptly, you know, basically pumped like 4 trillion yuan into the market. Of course, you do see a strong growth in the next year, in 2009, in the manufacturing sector. But now, of course, we are talking about the official PMI. It's mostly about the state-owned sector. Mm-hmm. You can see all the sub-indexes following this 51 reading here is also very positive in terms of like employment, in terms of like
imports,
new orders, exports.
Yeah.
So that's a very rosy picture for the you know, state sector, but at least we will see about the private sector. But on the whole, people have like a much, much better understanding, and also, you know, stability is the key word here.
Right? Yeah, the new orders rose to 52.4 from 50.6 in a month, you know, meaning more people wanting Chinese goods from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning yesterday, China's mobile phone users have to use their real names to register their phones. In accordance with the new policy, all new mobile phone users and those looking to change providers have to register with their real names in order to use offered services. Customers who did not register before must provide accurate personal information if they switch mobile phone plans. Mobile network operators which fail to cooperate with the new policy will be fined anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000 yuan.
I mean, I get this, and I understand why they would do this, but what's the thinking behind it? Why now? Why make people register with their names?
You know, people have been talking about this for years. It's a very big, I think it's a probably typical Chinese market at the very beginning. Yes, if you go to the China Mobile, speak their official office, representative office, usually you are required to show your ID card. You fill in the forms, your, say, home address and phone number, and also your ID numbers.
Right.
So that's a, you know, standard practice basically around the world.
I would dispute that. I would dispute that. I mean,
in the UK?
No, you just go in and buy your card, a SIM card, and that's it.
Anonymously.
Egypt, you can do that. Lebanon, you can do that. Israel,
I know in
that.
The United States, if you want to have a mobile phone, you have to.
Oh, yeah.
You have to register
your ID,
your home address. There's no way you just purchase a mobile phone card and then insert it into your phone.
Yeah. Oh, sure. But, you know, more countries don't do it. And even some of the bigger countries like Israel don't really track your thing. I mean, the most difficult place I've ever had to get a SIM card was Turkey.
Uh-huh.
Turkey has this control over how many SIM cards can go out, and you pay through the nose, you know, you pay a lot of money just to get a SIM card and registration at, you can't just buy off any vendors,
uh-huh.
you know, on the street. You have to go to a particular company like Turkcell or Vodafone or something to do it. Whereas here, well, you can just walk into any street and just say, if you have ID, fine. If you're a foreigner, they'll ask you for your ID anyway. But if you're Chinese, until yesterday,
yesterday.
A problem.
That's right. But those mostly you're referring to small agents, so-called vendors on the street.
Yeah.
You can purchase a SIM card, a mobile card, and then use it, you know, without providing your personal information. I personally have a problem with that. I think everybody should be registered because of the trouble that's created by this practice. You see, you do receive spam, a lot of from unknown numbers.
Yes.
And also sometimes fraudulent messages or phone calls from somebody you never know. They pretend to be a friend. They pretend to be your family member sometimes.
Yes.
And a lot of people were trapped, basically, by those kind of practices. So I would say from now on, every phone number will be traced to a real user. At least that's effective weapon against a spam.
One of the great pieces of advice since I've been in China was from Jingnan, actually. She said, don't ever answer a number you do not recognize. Don't ever call them back. You know, she told me.
Right, yeah, because it will cost you money if you call them back.
Yeah, oh, yeah, right, this okay. is one of those schemes, you know, like fraudulent schemes. So I dislike them so much.
I do feel slightly sorry for those fenders, though. I mean, they've had to dump all their phone cards and everything like that. I mean, how much money have they lost in the process?
But I think they can get a refund from, say, mobile operators.
Okay.
Officially. Yeah, that's not a problem. The thing is, like, it's a bit, like, you know, make it not troublesome, really. It takes more time, basically, to buy a SIM card. You have
you
to
mean
register
just like everything else in China?
Yeah, the ID card, so, yeah.
Well, new visa rules affecting foreigners in China have taken effect. Under the new rules, four new visa types will be introduced for foreign nationals entering China, bringing the total number from 8 to 12. The new visa types precisely indicate a foreign national's reasons for entering China, giving authorities more detailed information and providing more services to foreigners. The regulation also stipulates foreigners' visa applications should receive a reply within 7 days.
This is the one topic that I spent most of the weekend talking with with a friend who arrived in mid-June because his visa, he was one of the very last batch to get a visa from America that allows him a multi-entry visa over the course of the year. He has to leave the country every 90 days because it was the same price as a single entry. So he thought, well, there's no reason to just come in for a single entry when I can just come in any time, whatever, over a year. But he told me that he was the last batch because they were reforming the regulations. And it's long overdue. It hasn't been reformed since 1986. And, you know, as you and I know, just walking around Beijing, there are a lot of foreigners nowadays. You don't know if they're tourists or they work here. And many people who work here are also baffled by the regulations. Another friend of mine says he has to leave China end of this month, at some point this month, so that he can reapply when he goes to, like, Hong Kong or Vietnam or something, because it's so difficult to get a business visa nowadays.
Yeah, and also to renew your visa, probably.
Hell yeah.
yes, there are, I think on the whole, as mentioned, like 1986, so that's like 30 years ago. Of course, it's necessary to update those rules because, you know, changes have been taking place over the past several decades. You can see, like, since the year 2000, there's, like, an annual increase of 10% of foreign nationals coming to China, either for sightseeing or for job-seeking different purposes. But anyway, more and more people are coming to China to seek a job because of the prosperity of the Chinese economy, of course, and the rapid growth. So you do need to make changes, I would say. Due changes need to be made. To reflect the reality on the ground, I would say. And also, I think, let's say, lawyers would say it's more now in line with the practice in developed countries.
Sure.
So getting mature is getting normal, I would say, for the international practice to accept, to process, let's say, immigrants from other countries over here. And also, I think you can see the types of visa has been expanded from 8 to 12. And there's a different visa they call the Q, I think. That's for talent, you know, talented people or from other countries as long as they are accepted or given that kind of recognition by the Chinese side, then it's, you know, there is a special visa for them. So I guess
that rules
me out, then. Treatment.
I would never be on a queue.
Probably you could be in that exactly in that type of.
Oh, you're so nice to me. You're so nice. But on you know, for employers wanting to entice people to come here, it clears up the regulations a bit more. But it makes the whole thing a lot more bureaucratic potentially for them, which puts them off even further, maybe.
It depends on different, you know, there are some, I think, you know, like the gray area, let's say, especially for a lot of young people from North American countries or European countries, they come to China without really a clear mind of what they are going to do. The easiest job you can land, that is to teach English, right?
And
there is a problem. Yeah. Usually they don't go through the proper procedure. Of course, there will be a problem, right? So right now, I think, you know, people probably need to go back and follow the procedure, then there won't be a problem in the future.
Well, we'll see if any of my friends are still here in a month's time. Thanks, Sir Jingnan. That was China Report for Monday. Don't forget you can find us on our Weibo, Today_News+. Coming up, Mark is back to tell us about an app that allows you to share your leftover food with your lovely neighbours. You're back with Today on News Plus. I'm Ben Lung with Shujindo in a Global Talk with Monday's Online Unleashed. Here's Mark Vigley again.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Well, a new smartphone app has hit the market in the U.S., allowing food lovers to share their leftovers. All you simply have to do is take a picture of your leftover meal and upload it onto the new app called Leftover Swap. Your leftover food will appear on the phones of other nearby Leftover Swap users browsing the app. And if you're looking to eat someone's leftovers and find something you like, you can arrange to pick it up or have it delivered.
Well, Wuhu Wahu Wan from the LA Times chimes in. No, I would not eat leftovers from a stranger. Who knows what would be left in those leftovers? Yes, many people have good intentions, but what about that axiom? The road to the to hell is paved with good intentions.
Mm-hmm. DD from the Daily Mail says, I see the concept of the idea. I always make too much food anyway and have leftovers. I think about how I don't want to throw away, but I do. The idea is silly, though. What happens when someone gets food poisoning from this? Especially in America, where they love to sue each other for everything they can.
Well, Pepper Trekker from Huffington Post writes, if I have good leftovers, I eat them for lunch the next day. If they're bad, I leave them or throw them out later. I wouldn't eat another person's leftovers, even if they were from an expensive French restaurant.
Very true. I mean, I live alone, so I have leftovers all the time. And if someone drags me out for the night, then I don't get to cook. Because I eat lunch at work, and mm-hmm. dinner, that's gone. So I have that for breakfast. And then if I don't have that for breakfast, I just chuck it in the freezer. Because what baffles me is, food is going off and all the rest of it. Chuck it in the freezer.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Right, chuck it in the freezer. Yeah. And then you can defrost it at a time when you think you will be at home, maybe like later on in the day or tomorrow. Then you can have it then. But I don't see why... People feel the need to give away the leftovers. You don't even know how to chop it.
Well, this is just one way to deal with your leftovers, I guess. Of course, in your case, your leftovers is totally clean, you know, untouched. Of course, this, you know, I think for your neighbor or your friends, definitely they're welcome just to pick up.
But if we talk about someone 2 kilometers away you've never met, hello, I believe you have some bolognese left for me.
Probably not, especially in Beijing.
Yeah, exactly.
It takes too long time for them to reach your place.
Yeah, even 15th floor to the 10th floor is too long a trip, right? You know, and you think, okay, there's some hair here. What do I do? Yeah. You know, I don't know who you are.
Oh, that's from Ben, no.
But, I mean, what are you guys doing to your food when you eat it? I mean, I'm a pretty clean eater. I'm not shaking my hair over my food. I get this app. I would totally use this. Absolutely.
Really?
I mean,
you would cook... Well, all right, sure. I mean, Yeah, I know restaurants aren't that clean. You know, if food drops on the floor, then they just scrape it back on a plate and give it to you. But I don't know. I'm still a bit... at least if I go to a restaurant, I know whom to sue. But I wouldn't know whom to sue if it's someone from the 15th floor.
Right.
Or would I want to sue them or not.
But if I'm making the food, I keep that food for leftovers. Absolutely. I wouldn't use it for that. I would use it if someone's trying to get rid of half a piece of pizza. I mean, hey, that's a free half a pizza. That's great. And if it has pepperoni on it, all the better.
Sure, but get your own.
Well, you see, Ben, there are different people, you know, different people with different practice. So sure. I think this is app not for everybody, obviously.
Yeah, right? But there is one good thing about China, having been here a while, is having just come from Egypt, where leftover food is a horrible problem because there's so much bread and people just don't eat the bread. Mm-hmm. They give you 9 pieces of bread for one person. How are you supposed to eat that
for one person?
Along with meat and salad and a soup, you know, just for one sitting.
It's impossible.
You know, whereas China is a lot better, but I'm not saying it's perfect, but...
Yeah. Other comments. Let's take a look at Norman East, or Oman from the Daily Mail suggests, here's an idea. How about you don't take so much onto your plate or request a smaller helping size? Whenever I've had takeaways, the single portions have been enough for 2 people. We've got used to helpings getting bigger and seeing them as better as value. Let's face it, we are greedy.
Turkish Delight from the Huffington Post weighs in, what a ridiculous idea. So you're supposed to sit around for hours hoping someone comes along to claim your leftovers? I give mine to my dogs, but if I didn't have any dogs, I have better things to do than sit around hoping and waiting to let strangers into my house to mug me.
Lock Wind, also from the Huffington Post, disagrees. I know this idea sounds kind of off-putting to some, but honestly, I'm all for it. America has a huge problem with food waste. I get absolutely disgusted when I see waiters take away half-eaten plates of food. This app appeals strongly to people like me who are morally opposed to wasting food. But then at the same time, you know, there's a law in California that says you can't sell food without some kind of a license. So is this like selling food to one another? Or is
giveaway.
This... Yeah, you can't do that either, right? So there's all sorts of legal implications. Oh, good for the lawyers again. But, you know, there's all sorts of legal implications going on here.
But yeah. I think what you said, there's a real problem that is a potential issue. Let's say if somebody gets sick from eating your leftover, then there will be a problem.
Absolutely.
That's a bit troublesome, seems to me. But also, I think that's a good suggestion. Like, so, you know, order your food with a smaller size instead if you're not that hungry or you're not a good eater, right?
Yeah, or give it to old people, you know, in old people's homes. I mean, I don't know, rather than just saying, come around to my house and pick it up, why don't you just put it all in a doggy bag and just chuck it down at the nearest community center or something? Or give, or what I do is give it to homeless people along the way. You know, if they moan about, you know, I mean, in the past, I've given bread away to homeless people on the streets of Cairo and they said, that's it? Well, I said, well, what do you mean? You're hungry, aren't you? Oh, I said, there's no hummus, no jam, nothing to go with it. And I said, well, you know, don't be so picky, you're homeless. But in Beijing, there are lots of old people standing outside subway stations. So I just, you know, if I have any leftover food in my bag, I'll just give it to them. And they always take it.
But imagine the practice is mostly people will take away with them and probably, you know, chucking in the refrigerator for next time, right?
Good on them. Chinese people always always scrimping around for food. So that's a practice that Americans could well learn, you know. Thanks, Mark. Oh, hope to hear back from you tomorrow. Up next, incompetent robbers all round. This is Today on News Plus.
Online, on air, and on your phone. Take Today wherever you go and stay ahead of what's changing our world. From politics and the economy to business and technology, Today covers regional and international issues that affect China and the world. Keep up to date with Today.
You're listening to Today. I'm Xu Jianduo with Ben Lian. Closing us out for the day is Will.
Thanks, Jianduo. Well, new flash for potential thieves. If you are going to rob someone, make sure you're dressed appropriately. In the U.S., a Brooklyn cell phone robber was arrested after tripping on his sagging jeans during an on-foot police chase. Witness Erlyn Williams allegedly says he was zigzagging all over the place, but he couldn't run because his pants were falling down.
Well, you see a lot of that in America. You know, their jeans are almost on their ankles, and all you can see is
sagging pants.
Sagging pants, and all you can see is their bottom wigging around in the you know, on the streets of Brooklyn or wherever. Yeah, well, stupid robbers. They don't think about that, obviously. They think about how they look first, then rob.
No, they would say there will be like probably a successful operation, and they don't need to run. Yeah, especially by being pursued by the police, right?
Well, an American radio station's ad about an alien invasion frightened several listeners into calling the police. Brian Rickman, director of Alabama 94.9, explained the concept being that the aliens heard our frequency. They didn't like Justin Bieber and the music we played, and they were going to take over the radio station and adjust the format. Later, Rickman found himself getting frantic phone calls from the police and school superintendents over whether an invasion from outer space was actually occurring.
Well, and local law enforcement opted to beef up some school security anyway in preparation for the aliens' 9 a.m. takeover. So this is not April Fool's. This is
no.
This is people in Alabama being completely stupid. Just extremely gullible.
Gullible, I would say. Probably.
I say stupid.
People somehow like obsessed with the aliens. Otherwise, you wouldn't believe, right?
We would never do this on this radio station, would we?
No.
Never broadcast anything irresponsibly. Most of the time. Chindu, what's on a big debate tomorrow?
Well, we'll discuss the free trade zone in Shanghai.
Yes, lovely stuff, isn't it? Remember, you can send us your comments on our Weibo, weibo.com/today_news+, from Shu Jindo and myself, Ben Lung, and all of us here on Today. Goodbye.